Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. Imagine this for a second. You finally left. Escaped a repressive regime, made it across borders, found refuge somewhere democratic, miles away. You think, okay, I'm safe now. Beyond their reach. But then, maybe an email lands in your inbox. A bit chilling. Or a comment on social media feels targeted. Or worse, you hear your family back home is being questioned about you, about what you're doing now. Suddenly, those borders you crossed, they don't feel quite so solid. Today, we're diving headfirst into that unsettling reality. We're exploring something that's really reshaping global politics. The topic is the digital diaspora. When exiles become strategic threats or assets, Ofera. We'll be looking at how authoritarian regimes are, well, extending their reach digitally, how exiles are fighting back with those same tools, and, crucially, what all this means for the security, even the sovereignty, of the countries offering refuge. It's messy. And joining me to help unravel these complex layers, as always, is our expert.
It's great to be here. And yeah, this topic really sits at the heart of how power functions today, doesn't it? In this super connected world, it shows how those old ideas about borders, well, they're being fundamentally challenged. We'll be digging into some fascinating research to get a handle on this this really intricate dance between regimes and their people scattered across the globe.
Exactly. And this deep dive is brought to you by the Security Nexus. We're really proud to partner with them. The Security Nexus, they're a Maryland-based national security consultancy. They specialize in strategic advisory, education, public engagement. Through things like this, blogs, training, consulting, they offer insight into, you know, cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, all the evolving stuff. Their whole mission is to inform, educate, and empower professionals, the public, everyone. With clear, actionable knowledge, you can find out much more about their important work at thesecuritynexus.net. Definitely check them out. So to guide us through this landscape today, we've got some really excellent scholarship to lean on. We're drawing insights from Marcus Michelson's 2016 work, Exit and Voice in a Digital Age. Mm-hmm. Also, Dana Moss's 2016 articles, The Ties That Bind and Transnational Repression and the Arab Spring. Very insightful.
And Derek Conduit's 2020 paper, Authoritarian Power in Space, Time, and Exile. That one really shifts perspective.
There's another piece by Marcus Michelson, this one co-authored with Johannes Slimfart from 2022, called Drawing a Line.
Plus, Fiona Adamson's 2020 contribution, Non-State Authoritarianism and Diaspora Politics, adds another layer of complexity.
And finally, Arne Wackenhut and Camilla Orjuela's 2023 article, Engaging the Next Generation.
Yeah.
Okay, quite a lineup. Let's unpack this fascinating topic and see what key insights we can uncover for you. One. The new battlefield, digitalization of exit and voice. All right, so let's start with basics, maybe, these core ideas. Exit and voice.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, you know, from Albert Hirschman, The Economist, he kind of saw them as, well, mutually exclusive, right?
Hmm.
If you're unhappy with something, like your government, you can either exit, leave, emigrate, basically check out, or you could voice protest, complain, try to change things from within.
Exactly. And the traditional thinking was if you chose exit, you pretty much gave up your voice. You left, you were gone. Your ability to influence things back home diminished significantly.
But that's where our sources say things have fundamentally shifted. The digital age changed the rules.
Completely. It's revolutionary, really. This is what Marcus Michelson gets into in Exit and Voice in a Digital Age. He points out how digital communication tech, the internet, social media, encrypted apps, all of it empowers dissidents. Even after they've left authoritarian countries, they can actually continue political activism from exile.
So leaving doesn't mean silence anymore.
Not at all. They can stay involved in debates back home. They can feed information to international audiences. They can build external pressure on the regime. It totally flips Hirschman's original idea on its head. Exit can now amplify voice, not extinguish it.
Okay, but here's the catch, right? It's not all straightforward empowerment. Michelson points out, and this seems crucial, that while digital media offer these new avenues for voice, they also, quote, create multiple points of exposure that state actors can exploit.
Ah, yes, the double-edged sword. Absolutely. It's a constant cat-and-mouse game. These same tools that enable activism also make activists incredibly vulnerable to surveillance and attack.
It's like the digital space becomes this new kind of border, almost. Invisible, but maybe even harder to cross safely.
That's a really good way to put it. And it connects to what Dara Conduit talks about in her paper, Authoritarian Power in Space, Time, and Exile.
Hmm.
Historically, authoritarian reach was, you know, mostly limited by physical borders. You got out, you were generally safer. Maybe not totally, but mostly.
Right. Think Cold War defectors.
Exactly. But Conduit introduces this concept of the topology of power. It's fascinating. She argues power doesn't just travel in straight lines based on distance. It can be strong over vast distances and maybe weak nearby, depending on how it's mediated.
So physical distance isn't the main factor anymore.
Not necessarily. Digital connections can make someone feel very close, even if they're continents away. It bends our usual understanding of geography and power. Power can kind of fold space, bringing regimes and exiles into proximity in ways that weren't possible before.
Okay, so what does this actually mean for these activists in exile? They've physically exited, but digitally, they're still in the fight.
It means that their voice after exit is, well, it's more potent, but also way more perilous than ever before. Michelson uses O'Donnell's distinction here between vertical voice talking to the government and horizontal voice talking amongst citizens.
Ah, okay. Vertical is protest upwards. Horizontal is organizing sideways.
Precisely. And authoritarian regimes hate horizontal voice. That's where shared grievances build, where collective action starts. They do everything to stop people connecting with each other.
Makes sense. You can't organize if you can't talk.
But the internet, it's inherently networked. It's built for horizontal connection. It lets geographically scattered people find each other, share interests, build communities online, even from exile, so that horizontal voice becomes a powerful tool even from thousands of miles away. It bypasses the state's old control mechanisms.
And these exiles aren't just, like, venting online, are they? They're playing a more strategic role. Michelson calls them bridge figures in transnational advocacy networks. What does that involve?
It's a vital function. They act as conduits, really. They connect the inside and the outside. They use digital platforms to spread information that regimes suppress. They publicize demands from activists still on the ground. They frame issues for international media or governments.
So they're translating and amplifying.
And brokering relationships, connecting grassroots groups with international NGOs, maybe connecting victims with human rights lawyers, raising awareness among policymakers in their host countries. They become these crucial strategic assets for change movements. They turn local struggles into global issues. That's real power. Two, authoritarian regimes strike back. Tactics of transnational repression.
Okay, so it's clear exiles have found new, powerful ways to make their voices heard, digitally amplify voices. But logically, authoritarian regimes aren't just going to stand by and let this happen, right? They're going to react.
Oh, absolutely not. They adapt. And they adapt ruthlessly. Our sources show they're projecting power beyond their borders in ways that are, frankly, quite chilling. And they're using digital tools to do it.
This is where transnational repression comes in. How is that defined? Data Moss writes about this.
Yes. Moss, in her work on the Arab Spring, defines it really clearly. It's basically the direct and indirect efforts by home country regimes to control their citizens abroad. So surveillance of diaspora communities, threats against activists, making it impossible for them to return home safely.
And even punishing family members back home.
Yes, that's a key tactic. Using family as leverage for perceived disloyalty. It's a whole strategy to extend control way beyond physical borders.
And we should remember, this isn't entirely new, is it? The digital part might be new, but the impulse to control citizens abroad has a history.
That's a crucial point. It's an evolution, not a completely novel phenomenon. Michael Selson's work on Iran points this out. The Iranian state has a long, grim history of this. Think back to the Shah's Secret Service, SAVAK, infiltrating student groups in Europe in the 70s, or the Islamic Republic assassinating Kurdish opposition figures in places like Berlin in the 90s. Those were physical, brutal acts.
Right, and Moss mentions Libya under Gaddafi, too.
Yes, the Libyan regime ran an assassination program targeting dissidents in Europe and the U.S. in the 80s and 90s. There was that infamous incident in London in 84, where officials fired from the embassy at protesters, killing a British policewoman. So the intent to reach beyond borders has always been there for some regimes. The digital age just gives them new, often stealthier tools.
Okay, so let's talk about those digital tools. What does digital transnational repression, or DTR, actually look like?
Michael Sin and Thumfart, in their Drawing a Line paper, explain that DTR often combines digital threats with those traditional offline methods. It's a blend. Regimes still filter and block the internet inside their borders, obviously. But DTR involves targeted surveillance of specific people outside, persecuting online criticism, and infiltrating activist networks digitally.
So hacking, phishing, that sort of thing.
Yes, but often very sophisticated versions. It adds speed, scale, and often this layer of plausible deniability makes it harder to trace back definitively.
Can you give us some specific examples? You mentioned Iran as a key case study here.
Absolutely. Michelson's 2016 paper delves deep into Iran, especially after the 2009 Green Movement. The regime saw that largely online-fueled movement as a soft war. Their response was multi-layered. They pressure staff at Farsi services of places like BBC or Voice of America. How? By arresting or harassing their families back in Iran. And they run smear campaigns against these journalists in state media. It's psychological warfare.
Wow. And online?
Online, they use DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service, to knock external Farsi news sites offline, especially during critical moments. They target activists' emails and social media with phishing. Very targeted phishing. Michelson gives this chilling example. An Iranian tech expert, Arash Saad, was detained in Tehran. Shortly after, phishing emails were sent from his account to his contacts.
That's terrifying. State-sponsored identity theft, essentially. Yeah.
And they use social engineering heavily. This isn't just random hacking attempts. They gather detailed personal info, hobbies, friends, family, routines to craft customized traps. Emails or messages that look legitimate, tricking people into giving up passwords or clicking malicious links. They even try to bypass two-factor authentication. It shows a real commitment of resources.
The level of sophistication is incredible. What's the impact on the activists themselves? Beyond the technical headache.
It's immense. Michelson quotes activists like the journalist Negar Mortazavi, who call it an extra burden. They have to constantly worry about cybersecurity, learn about threats, take precautions. It's exhausting, and it distracts from their actual work. Another activist, Reza, mentions avoiding posting location info, asking conferences not to publish his bio online, all to prevent social engineering. It forces a kind of constant self-censorship and paranoia.
And the offline threats continue alongside this.
Oh, yes. They're often intertwined. Shireen Ebadi, the Nobel laureate, faces constant judicial harassment, property confiscation in Iran, even direct death threats, all aimed at silencing her advocacy from exile. Mansour Sharjay, a women's rights activist, got summoned for interrogation back in Tehran because of her work in Europe. Think of the pressure that puts on her family still there.
So it's not just about stopping their work, it seems. It's about isolating them, cutting them off.
That's a huge part of it. Michelson outlines how these tactics aim to distance exiles. First, they attack professional links. Contacts inside Iran get arrested or pressured based on compromised communications with exiles. This makes sources wary of talking to external media. It dries up the flow of information, creates a chilling effect.
Makes reporting incredibly difficult and dangerous for everyone involved.
Exactly. Second, they target personal ties. This is often the most effective and cruel tactic. Harassing family members. Vahid Parastad, a journalist, had family interrogated to stop his reporting. Masih Alinejad, who runs the anti-mandatory hijab campaign, shared how security agents told her father she was morally corrupt and pressured him to disown her. Shiri Abadi's sister was jailed, her husband pressured horrifically. Using family is a powerful lever.
It forces an impossible choice.
It does. And third, smear campaigns in state media, portraying activists as spies, traitors, sexually immoral. Abadi's husband was forced onto TV to denounce her after being entrapped. Alinejad constantly faces campaigns calling her a prostitute or foreign agent. These often use sexualized attacks knowing they'll resonate and damage reputations in conservative parts of society. It aims to discredit and isolate.
Let's look at Syria, too. Dana Moss talks about networked authoritarianism there. What did that look like?
Moss's work, The Ties That Bind, shows how the Assad regime used ICTs to extend its reach globally during the Arab Spring. Syrians in the diaspora faced widespread hacking, chilling threats from pro-regime individuals or agents. Mara Bukai got graphic rape threats for her anti-Assad work. Dr. Radwan Ziadeh received threats via Facebook, including hints that were watching him physically at protests abroad.
Real-time surveillance feeding into online threats.
Precisely. And the case of Ala Basatna is striking. She was a student in the U.S., coordinating protests in Damascus by subtitling and uploading videos from Syria. But then an associate inside Syria was caught, forced to give up his Facebook password. The regime used that access to target Ala directly. Online death threats, offline threats from a Syrian consulate worker in the U.S.
In the U.S., that crosses a major line.
It did. It led to an FBI investigation and the conviction of Mohammed Suaid for acting as an illegal foreign agent, spying on protesters in the U.S. for the Syrian regime. The regime also used social media platforms against activists, reporting pages like, "We are all Hamza al-Khatib," named after a tortured child, for offensive content to get them taken down, silencing dissent via the platform's own rules.
This constant pressure, digital and physical, it must create a pervasive climate of fear, even in supposedly safe countries.
Absolutely. The psychological impact is immense. Activists self-censor. Moss talks about network erosion, people unfriending contacts online to avoid attracting attention or putting others at risk. It fractures the community. Public figures might push through the harassment, but the fear for family back home is paralyzing. And for less public diaspora members, it's incredibly effective at deterring even casual engagement. It reinforces the regime's power, making people feel watched and unsafe thousands of miles away. 3, beyond the state. Non-state authoritarianism in diasporas.
Okay, so we've seen how states extend their repressive reach. But the story gets even more complicated, doesn't it? Fiona Adamson's work, Non-State Authoritarianism and Diaspora Politics, introduces another layer. She argues that diaspora communities themselves, often seen as spaces of freedom, can sometimes be, well, authoritarian.
Yeah, this is a really important and maybe uncomfortable insight. It challenges that...
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Often romanticized view of diasporas as purely democratic havens. Adamson asks, can diaspora politics itself be authoritarian? And her answer is yes. She shows how non-state actors within a diaspora political groups, militant organizations, sometimes use the exact same illiberal, anti-democratic, even violent tactics as the states they oppose.
Why would they do that?
Could be ideology, a rigid belief system that demands conformity. Or it could be strategic, a way to dominate the diaspora, control resources, and eliminate rivals, to ensure their group is the only voice. It reveals a darker side to diaspora politics that often gets overlooked.
So groups fighting against authoritarianism might mimic its methods within their own community. That's deeply ironic.
It is. And Adamson lists the tactics. They mirror state repression remarkably closely. Assassinations of rivals within the diaspora, intimidation, threats, demanding ideological purity, top-down control structures, demands for absolute loyalty, even personality cults around leaders.
Yeah.
This creates what she calls competitive authoritarianism within the diaspora. Ordinary members get squeezed from both sides, repressed by their home state and potentially by powerful non-state groups within their own exiled community. Plus, maybe facing discrimination in the host country, too. It's a triple burden.
The Turkish and Kurdish situation seems like a prime example of these overlapping dynamics.
It's a very stark illustration, yes. First, you have the Turkish state's long history of controlling its diaspora in Europe, using embassies, consulates, intelligence for surveillance, the infamous passport harassment, canceling passports to force people back or into asylum limbo, using state-sent teachers to gather intel on community groups. And after the 2016 coup attempt, they really ramped it up, targeting Kurds, targeting Gulen movement members, demanding extraditions, even handing surveillance lists to German authorities, a clear attempt to project power onto European soil.
Okay, so that's the state side. But then there's the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. They've been targets, but Adamson says they've also been perpetrators.
Exactly. This is crucial. The PKK, while undeniably a target of severe Turkish state repression that extended abroad, has also engaged in transnational repression within the Kurdish diaspora. Adamson documents their use of violence against rival Kurdish groups, assassinations like Komkar members killed in Sweden and Germany in the 80s and 90s.
So internal consolidation of power through violence.
Yes, and seeking to dominate civic life. Using intimidation to secure support, control community resources, there are stories of businesses being attacked for not complying with demands. Widespread extortion was a major issue, especially in Germany in the 90s. Reports linked the PKK to a huge percentage of extortion cases. They were also involved in illicit trade in places like London to fund activities and assert control.
And vulnerability plays a role here.
Absolutely. Many diaspora members were refugees or undocumented, making them reluctant to go to host country police. They were trapped. And centrally, the PKK built this intense personality cult around its leader, Abdullah Öcalan. Some call it the Apocular Diaspora, that demands ideological conformity. It's a clear parallel to state authoritarianism.
It's a chilling parallel. What about this Sri Lankan case? The LTTE, the Tamil Tigers.
Sri Lanka offers another powerful example of this dual repression. After the LTTE's military defeat in 2009, the Sri Lankan government saw the Tamil diaspora as an existential threat, fearing continued funding and lobbying for separatism.
So the state ramped up its own transnational repression.
Yes. Direct surveillance of diaspora members abroad, like showing UK Tamils photos of themselves at protests, interrogating and even torturing returnees about their activities, abducting or harassing family members of activists back in Sri Lanka, standard brutal tactics. And they successfully lobbied Western governments to ban the LTTE as a terrorist group, using the post-9/11 war on terror narrative to legitimize their crackdown and criminalize diaspora support.
But again, like the PKK, the LTTE wasn't just a victim. They also wielded power within the diaspora.
Very much so. The LTTE operated as a highly effective non-state authoritarian actor globally. They had a centralized structure, a powerful personality cult around their leader, Prabhakaran. They even maintained a computer database tracking Tamils in the diaspora, quite sophisticated for a non-state group.
Yeah.
Human Rights Watch documented horrific abuses by the LTTE against dissenting Tamils abroad. Death threats, beatings, property destruction, smear campaigns, even murder. Sabaratnam Sabalingam, killed in Paris in 94 as he was about to publish an anti-LTTE book.
So dissent was ruthlessly suppressed.
Absolutely. They used threats against family in Sri Lanka as leverage. They dominated civic organizations, NGOs, temples, often for fundraising. Widespread extortion was common, demanding thousands from individuals, tens of thousands from businesses. They even had their own version of passport harassment, confiscating passports of Tamils returning to Sri Lanka until a fee was paid.
Unbelievable.
And their involvement in crime, like gangs and illicit trade in cities like London and Toronto, blurred lines and tragically led to the criminalization of the wider Tamil community in some places.
So across these cases, it's this complex, often brutal picture. Both states and non-state groups using authoritarian methods to control diasporas, creating these battlegrounds far from home, trapping people in the middle. 4, the deeper implications, sovereignty, self-determination, and host states. Okay, this leads to a really crucial question, one that maybe doesn't get asked enough. How does all this transnational repression from states or non-state groups actually affect the host countries? The places where these exiles live. It feels like more than just a human rights issue for the individuals involved. It feels like it touches on the host state's own security, its own authority, its sovereignty.
That's exactly the argument Michelson and Thumfart make in Drawing a Line, and it's a powerful one. They argue that DTR, digital transnational repression, isn't just about violating the rights of an individual exile. It actively interferes with the interests, the authority, the sovereignty of the host state itself. It raises fundamental national security questions for the host country.
And reframing it that way is important, isn't it? Because sometimes democracies might hesitate to call out human rights abuses by other states due to politics or diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
But framing it as an attack on their own sovereignty, that changes the conversation. Makes it an internal security issue.
It absolutely changes the discourse. It provides a stronger, more universally accepted basis for condemning these actions. Even states like China or Russia, who constantly invoke sovereignty to deflect criticism, would find it harder to justify actions framed as violating another state's sovereignty. Michelson and Thumfart lay out 3 international law arguments for why DTR violates host state sovereignty. It's quite compelling.
Okay, what are they?
First, extraterritorial enforcement jurisdiction. Basically, acts like a foreign government hacking a phone located within the host country. That's a governmental action on foreign soil. Think of the Khashoggi case, the alleged hacking of his associate's phone while that associate was abroad. Under international law, That kind of enforcement action on foreign territory is illegal without consent. It's like sending agents across the border physically. They argue the key factor is where the violation happens, where the victim is harmed, not where the server is located. That brings digital attacks under territorial sovereignty.
Makes sense. What's the second argument?
Second, interference with national self-determination. DTR interferes with the host state's domain reserve, its internal affairs. By silencing or distorting diaspora voices within the host country's public debates, foreign regimes are indirectly messing with the host state's own democratic processes. They're skewing the information available to the public and policymakers. That interferes with the host state's ability to make its own sovereign decisions, especially on foreign policy. It's meddling.
Okay, so it undermines democratic deliberation. And the third.
Third, violation of the host state's capacity to protect rights. Host countries choose to uphold certain rights, freedom of speech, asylum, privacy. When a foreign regime targets exiles on the host's territory, digitally or physically, it undermines the host state's ability to guarantee those rights to people under its protection. It's a direct challenge to the host state's rule of law and its capacity to govern its own territory effectively. It violates sovereignty by crippling its protective function.
So, strong legal arguments. But beyond the law, there's also a clear self-interest for host states to act, right? These actions have tangible negative impacts domestically.
Absolutely. Michelson and Thumfart stress this. DTR undermines the host state's own credibility and authority. It creates real domestic problems. They cite examples. Like in Germany, Syrian regime intimidation of witnesses in a war crimes trial directly obstructed the German judicial process. That's a direct hit on sovereignty. Or the Turkish government encouraging denunciations via a smartphone app among the diaspora in Germany. That potentially violated German laws on data protection and espionage, and actively encouraged actions against German legislation.
Undermining the host country's laws.
Exactly. Or Eritrean refugees in Canada being pressured by their embassy to break Canadian law by funding military activities back home. All these actions erode trust in public institutions within the host country. Why trust the police if they can't protect you from your old regime? It sows division within diaspora communities and wider society. It hinders integration. It creates social cohesion risks and internal security vulnerabilities. It turns an external problem into an internal one.
So it really comes down to this. Protecting exiles isn't just altruism or foreign policy. It's about protecting the integrity and security of the host nation itself. 5. Countering transnational repression. Pathways forward. Okay, given how damaging and pervasive this is, what can host states actually do about it? Because right now, as you said, it often feels like the perpetrators get away with it. There's a degree of impunity.
That's the challenge, absolutely. Political will often gets trumped by economic ties or geopolitical strategy, even with physical attacks like Khashoggi. Digital threats have even lower costs for the regimes. But impunity isn't inevitable. Michelson and Thumfart lay out several pathways forward, concrete strategies host states can use.
Yeah, what's the first one? Something foundational, perhaps?
Yes, first is distributed cybersecurity. This isn't just about governments protecting themselves. It's a human-centric approach. It's about empowering civil society groups and individual migrants, the targets themselves, with the knowledge and tools to protect themselves.
So cybersecurity awareness and education for diaspora communities.
Yeah.
Yes, but also actively exposing the methods used by repressive regimes, making the invisible visible. Think of Citizen Lab's work exposing the Pegasus spyware vulnerability on an activist's phone. That discovery wasn't just academic. It forced Apple to push an emergency update to billions of devices worldwide. Apple then pledged funding for more research like that. This creates a kind of collective digital immune system. When individuals are empowered to spot threats, the whole community is safer.
That makes sense. A bottom-up defense. What about top-down actions?
Yeah.
Law enforcement, intelligence.
That's the second pathway, counterintelligence and law enforcement activities. Host country agencies need to see DTR as a specific threat within the broader category of foreign interference. They need dedicated efforts to detect it, constrain it, disrupt it. The FBI, for instance, does investigate foreign agents engaging in transnational repression in the U.S. They see it as a violation of sovereignty. We've seen charges brought against Chinese nationals for digital surveillance, against former Twitter employees spying for Saudi Arabia. These actions send a message.
So investigations and prosecutions are key.
Yes, and potentially even offensive cyber operations, defensively used. like U.S. Cyber Command blocking Russian troll farms or Facebook disrupting Chinese espionage against Uyghurs. But crucially, this must include outreach and building trust with the targeted communities. Authorities need to proactively warn refugees, see them as people at risk, not as security risks themselves, their potential allies against authoritarianism.
That shift in perspective seems vital. Okay, what about sanctions? Are they useful here?
Third pathway, sanctions. They are a vital tool for imposing costs. The U.S. Khashoggi ban is a good example. It allows visa restrictions on individuals involved in serious extraterritorial actions against dissidents. It implicitly reinforces sovereignty. If you engage in this on our soil or against our residents, you're not welcome here. The EU has a global human rights sanctions regime too, but it hasn't been applied much specifically to DTR yet. Using these tools more robustly would definitely raise the stakes for perpetrators. Targeting individuals can be very effective.
Makes it personal for the officials involved. And finally, what about the bigger picture? International norms.
Fourth, international norm development. This is longer term, but essential. We need stronger shared understandings, stronger norms against DTR in cyberspace. Companies like Microsoft have called for a digital Geneva Convention, rules of the road for state behavior online. Right now, the ambiguity around digital sovereignty allows these practices to thrive. Strengthening norms through diplomacy, through international agreements, is crucial to push back against this digital Wild West. We need clearer lines about what's unacceptable.
So fundamentally, it's about seeing this differently. Protecting exiles isn't just about their human rights, as vital as that is. It's about reinforcing the host state's own security, its own democratic resilience, its own sovereignty.
Exactly. These political exiles, often targeted precisely because they champion liberal values, should be seen as strategic allies. Allies against disinformation, against authoritarian encroachment. Leveraging the principle of sovereignty, the sovereignty effect, to guarantee their safety and rights protects not only them, but the host nation itself from insidious forms of foreign interference. Their fight is, in a very real sense, our fight too.
Wow, that's a really powerful way to frame it. We've covered so much ground here, from how digital tools empower exiles to the really disturbing way states and even non-state groups reach across borders to silence them, and now how host nations need to step up, not just for the exiles, but for themselves.
It really underscores how the digital world has blurred lines, hasn't it? It's changed how power works, how resistance happens, and the fate of these diaspora communities is, you know, deeply tangled up with the health and security of liberal democracies everywhere.
It definitely leaves us with a lot to think about, and it brings up a crucial question for you, our listener. In this world of porous digital borders, where transnational repression is clearly a growing threat, how do you think we strike the right balance? How can states and individuals protect basic freedoms, protect national sovereignty, without shutting down the very digital pathways that give people a voice and allow connection in the first place? It's a tough needle to thread. Something worth mulling over. We want to extend our sincere thanks to the scholars whose work made this deep dive possible. Marcus Michelson, Dana Moss, Dara Conduit, Johannes Sumfert, Fiona Adamson, Arne Wackenhut, and Camilla Orquella. Their research is truly vital. And thank you, as always, for joining us on the Security Nexus Deep Dive. Please do visit thesecuritynexus.net to learn more about their mission to inform, educate, and empower. We'll be back soon with another deep dive into the security insights that matter. Until then, keep learning, keep asking questions, and stay informed.